to a party and you don't know a single person in the room, chances are, if you're a typical human being, that you'll feel some sense of social disease, a little bit of vulnerability. It's very typical of being human. Now, I know there are a few extroverts among us who go to a party without knowing a single person, and they think, wow, this is such a great opportunity to make a bunch of new friends. But the rest of us feel just a little bit vulnerable in that kind of situation. But what if I were able to give you something, able to have you ingest something that would make your social fear ebb away, that would magically make you feel elevated, more confident, a better conversationalist, funnier, that would kind of make you feel like, hey, I own this room. Andy Crouch, a writer from whom I draw this scenario, points out that the moment that we begin to use alcohol as a way to manage our social vulnerability, we've gone from enjoying a very good part of God's creation, the fruit of the vine, to over-depending on something to deliver something that it was never intended to. When we cross the line and begin to over-depend upon alcohol, over-desire it, we find that this good gift begins to give less and less and take more and more, and in some cases will make us utterly vulnerable as we perhaps crash to the ground. Or as I've seen in certain situations where a person is so wasted that a friend has to grab them from around their back and clasp them by their belt buckle and lift them into the taxi because they're way too drunk to drive home. All of us have experienced our desires running amok for something. It might not be for alcohol, but it is certain that we have experienced our desires running awry so that they begin to give less and less and take more and more. Even the great apostle Paul knew what this was like. And so in Romans 7, the apostle Paul wrote, I do not understand what I do, for what I want to do, I do not do, but what I hate to do, I do. We are in a series right now called The Path to Freedom. And we've noted how back in 1935, a man known to history as simply Bill W. experienced his over desire for alcohol starting to give less and less and take more and more, to the point where the alcohol took everything that mattered to Bill: his work, his reputation, his family, his relationships, his health, even his freedom in more ways than one, as his alcoholism landed him in jail. And Bill hit a kind of rock bottom. He was humbled. But then Bill came to realize that his life was unmanageable on his own, that he needed a power greater than himself to restore his sanity. And he entrusted his existence into the care of God. As a result, Bill experienced a profound spiritual awakening. He began to follow Jesus. He joined a Christian fellowship called the Oxford Group, and he noticed that they were carefully studying the teaching of Jesus and seeking to apply it. He found that they engaged in practices like self-examination, like confessing their faults and their sins to each other, like seeking to make amends where they had harmed other people or damaged relationships. And Bill and a guy named Dr. Bob began to study the ways of Jesus with this group. And out of this study of the wisdom of Jesus, they formulated the group known as Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps. But the 12 steps aren't just for alcoholics. They help to free any of us who have experienced any kind of over-desire or over-dependence on something, whether it's food or sex or a relationship or control. And all of us have experienced some kind of overdependence or some kind of over-desire for something. So these steps really apply to each one of us. And tonight, as we continue our series on the spiritual life called The Path to Freedom, we're going to be looking at step number 4, which calls us to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of our lives. Let me take a moment to review. Step one of the 12 steps, as we looked at a couple of weeks ago, is to admit that we are powerless over, and whatever it is, fill in the blank, powerless to say no to, fill in the blank, and that our lives had become unmanageable. And there's nothing like a painful moment where we hit a kind of rock bottom to clarify the fact that we are not as in control as we think we are. Step two, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And we examined how this was true for King Nebuchadnezzar. Step three, last Sunday, we looked at how we can make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. And Jason Biasi opened up this step in a beautiful way as he preached from Romans 12. And then tonight we're going to look at step four, the call to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of our lives. And this is biblical. King David prayed in Psalm 139 these words, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. And see if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." Will you join me in a moment of prayer? Living God, we thank you that you are here in this room right now. And we ask that through the illuminating light of your Holy Spirit, you would search us. In fact, we pray the words of David, "Search us, O God, and know our heart. Test us and know our anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in us, and lead us in the way everlasting." Amen. And so tonight, as I've said, we're going to be looking at what it means to engage in step four of the 12 steps, a searching and fearless moral inventory of our lives. And in particular, we're going to be examining certain desires in our heart that may have run amok, that are giving less and less and taking more and more. And let me repeat, as I just mentioned, that doing this kind of searching and fearless moral inventory of our lives is biblical. David prayed, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." Jesus encouraged this kind of self-examination as well. In his famous Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 7, Jesus pointed out that we tend to spend a whole lot of time deeply examining the little specks of sawdust in other people's eyes, and we have no idea that there is this 2x4 stuck in our own eye. And so we look ridiculous. And so we would do a whole lot better if we spent less time obsessing over the speck of sawdust in that person's eye and spent more time considering the log in our own eye and examining the condition of our own hearts. And so Jesus would heartily endorse this searching and fearless moral inventory of our lives. So what does it mean to engage in a searching moral inventory of our lives, and a fearless one? Well, Bill W. and the folks at AA would tell us that a searching moral inventory simply means that we engage in a thorough moral inventory. I was at the dentist not long ago, sitting in the dentist chair, and my regular dentist was away, and so this guy comes into the room, and I'm laying back in the chair. And he says, "Hi, I'm Dr. Chris. Are you Ken Shigematsu, the pastor of 10th Church?" I say, "Yeah, it's me." He says, "I go to your church." And I'm thinking, maybe this is an advantage somehow. You know, we're part of the same spiritual family. Maybe he'll go easy on me, you know. Maybe he won't be quite as, thorough. Maybe he'll just skim over this examination. But there was another part of me, I think my better self, that was hoping that Dr. Chris would engage in a thorough examination of my teeth. And if there was some kind of decay in one of them or more of them, that he would drill down and remove the decayed part and fill it with white porcelain or whatever they use these days. And so it is when we engage in a searching moral inventory of our lives, where we're inviting God to do a thorough search of our souls. And if there is something decayed there, that we would invite God to also drill down, remove the decayed part, and fill it with something so that the whole can be filled and so that our souls can be whole. W-H-O-L-E. We are to also engage not only in a searching, thorough moral inventory, but a fearless one as well. And Bill W. and the folks at AA would say, fearless doesn't mean that we don't experience any anxiety as we do this search. Again, to return to the image of the dentist. You know, you're sitting in the dentist chair, and if the dentist identifies some kind of cavity, some kind of decay, I mean, you and I, in that situation, might want to jump out of the chair and say, stop! Stop in the name of love. Wasn't there a song like that by the Pointer Sisters? Stop in the name of love or in the name of compassion. And yet, again, if we engage in a fearless moral inventory, it's not that we don't experience the emotion of fear, but we won't let fear stop the dentist of our soul from continuing the search, drilling down and filling the hole in our soul that we might be made whole. Now, let me point out that as we consider the possibility of this deep dive of a searching and fearless moral inventory, that we absolutely need to understand that we are loved by God, that we are cherished by our Maker who does this inventory with us, or else this exercise could become one of morbid introspection. It could be one where we feel paralyzed. So know that you are treasured by a God who wants to see you whole and who wants to see you set free. So how do we actually engage in this deep dive? Well, Bill W. and the founders of AA would tell us that one of the best ways that we could engage this searching and fearless moral inventory is through the universally recognized seven deadly sins, which are pride, greed, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, and sloth. We're not going to cover all these, but we're going to look at some of these as a way into this searching and fearless moral inventory that we're called to. Pride. Let's take a look at this deadly sin. First of all, pride can be a very healthy emotion. If you feel pleasure over something that you've done really well, then that's a great emotion to have. God smiles with you. Or if you feel a sense of wonderment over the miracle that you are, that's also great to feel and something that God exalts in with you. But when pride crosses a line and causes us to become blinded to our own faults and shortcomings, when pride causes us to blame others for the problems in our life, when pride causes us to justify our excesses, then pride gives less and less and takes more and more. And this is precisely why Bill W. and Dr. Bob would have said that pride is the central vice, because it's the gateway to all the other vices. Pride causes us to be in denial about the darkness in our own soul. Pride causes us to rationalize our evils. And if pride is the central vice, then the central virtue is humility, because humility causes us to understand that on our own we are powerless to manage our lives. Humility causes us to recognize that we need a power greater than ourselves to restore our sanity, that we need to entrust ourselves into the care of God. Take sloth. And again, the desire to rest is a good thing. The longing for Sabbath is human, and it reflects the image of a God who rested on the seventh day of creation. But when our desire for rest becomes so excessive that we don't want to roll up our sleeves and actually work hard, then the desire for rest starts to give less and less and take more and more. Dag Hammarskjöld, The former Secretary General of the UN once said that the longest journey of all is the journey within. You travel to Asia, that's a long trip. You travel to Africa, that's a longer trip still. You go to Antarctica, like Sabine has been in a habit of doing, that is a longer trip even yet to go hang out with those penguins. But the longest trip of all, the longest journey of all, is the journey within. And I'm telling you that this searching and fearless moral inventory will require us to roll up our sleeves and work hard with God. But it is so worth it. It is so worth it. Anger is another one of the seven deadly sins. And again, anger can be a very good emotion. Anger over injustice and over oppression. A noble anger that I see evidenced in Pope Francis and in so many of you here at the Third Service. But when anger turns into resentment, it becomes toxic. And to resent simply means to refeel anger. And at some level to choose to refeel anger. And isn't it true that in some twisted way that resentment actually feels good because we feel superior to the people that we resent? But when anger turns to resentment, it starts to give less and less and take more and more and can eventually enslave us. I've been talking in abstractions up until this point as I'm describing some of the seven deadly sins. Let's hold up someone who illustrates anger and resentment. And I point you to my brother, Tetsuro, who's here tonight, as a case in point. And so I'm going to invite my brother Tetsuro to come and talk about how he's experienced anger and resentment towards someone important in our lives. And so if you'd come and just talk about that. It's my brother, by the way. Some of you know him, some of you haven't. My brother, Tetsuro Shigematsu.
Right now I'm feeling anger and resentment towards guess who? My name is Tetsuro, and apparently I represent anger. I am fury personified. Anger. Yeah. To be honest, to Ken's credit, he did give me a choice of seven deadly sins to talk about. We discussed this at length. He looked at me and said, "Hey, why don't you talk about pride? I bet you got some stories about sloth." Then he saw the look on my face and he said, "You know, I think we should go with anger." For a long time, I was really angry with my father. And when I got really mad, the one accusation I would throw in his face is, "You never talk to me unless you're mad at me. You never even look at me unless you think I did something," which I didn't, because it was actually Ken. "I didn't steal this stuff from Kmart. I'm 7 years old. I don't even have a bicycle." Ken, on the other hand, has a 10-speed that you bought him for his birthday, just saying. So yeah, a bit of anger, a bit of resentment towards a couple members of my family. The other reason I was angry towards my father was because my dad never hugged me, never said I love you. Right? I'm Asian. This is not unusual. A lot of you know what I'm talking about, right? Right? And honestly, I was completely fine with that. But now that I have two kids, 8 and 12, they're coming to the age where they're starting to have questions about their identity. Who am I? Where do I come from? And I know a day is coming very soon that they're going to start asking about Grandpa. And I didn't want to be in a position where I say, I don't know. I guess I should have asked. So about 2 years ago, I started interviewing my father when his health started to falter. I'm a former radio guy, so I got a tape recorder and started asking him questions, hours and hours of interviews. And I transcribed everything that he told me. And another reason why I was angry with my father was because he didn't love me the way I thought he should love me. He was so unlike the dads on TV. One of the interesting things I learned while interviewing my dad was a common memory that he shares with many Japanese of his generation in Japan was hearing the emperor's voice on the radio for the very first time, announcing Japan's defeat, Japan's surrender. Thank goodness, right? So while everyone else is crying around him, my dad is secretly happy because he's thinking, well, now that the war is finally over, maybe my father will come home. My grandfather was a prisoner of war. Now, back then, in my father's small hometown of Kagoshima, the only form of transportation that was left intact was the train system. So once a day, the train would make a stop at their local station. My father, being just a kid, didn't know any better, so he would go down to the local station to wait for his dad. So I said, okay, Dad, stop. I'm not saying yours was a fool's errand, but you don't know if your dad's alive or dead, so you just go down to the train station on the off chance that he'll just show up. But come on, you're 12 years old. How long can you keep this up? A week? A month? My father said, oh, not very long. Perhaps just over a year. Why'd you stop? There was only one person left on the platform that day, far too old to be my father. But I could see it was him. I said, Dad, did you run to him? Did you hug him? Did you say, I love you? No, of course not. Now I'm starting to get mad. Dad, father and son, parent and child, you guys haven't seen each other for years. You didn't know if the other was alive or dead. You're telling me the moment you two lay eyes on each other, you're telling me there wasn't the slightest expression of relief, of affection, happiness. There was nothing. After a really long time, my father said, I suppose it was the late afternoon when we walked home from the station because our shadows were so long on the road. And although I cannot be certain, I suppose had my father glanced at my shadow, he may have seen a slight hop in my step.
Thanks so much for sharing that story. And it seems to me that there was a time, quite a while, when you felt resentment and anger toward Dad. But then the anger was resolved. The resentment seemed to dissipate. Can you talk about that?
I think after listening and spending so much time with Dad, I was able to move into his world. And as I looked around his world, I realized, wow, your world is really different than my own. And it was only through hearing him openly that I was finally able to release him from my expectations. These are the rules for loving me, and I just managed to let go of that. You know, I get kind of a kick out of sharing a stage with my brother, because even though we both spend a lot of time on stage, it's almost never the same stage. And maybe some of you look at Ken and me and think, wow, pretty big contrast. You know, angelic countenance. Handsome devil, right? See, my brother It's incumbent upon my brother to cultivate a sense of true humility, right? But as an entertainer, I am bound by no such covenant. But if you know other members of my family, like, does anyone here know Setsu, for example? Anyone ever met Setsu? If you think Ken and I are different, you should meet Setsu, because she is wild. I mean, next to Setsu, I look like Ken, right? And when people meet all five of the kids, they often ask my parents, wow, what did you do? They're all so different. And maybe they mean that in a good way. I don't know. But my dad always says, I didn't do anything. And in a way that was true, because my father never did anything to impose his ambitions, his unfulfilled dreams, his own designs upon Ken, myself, upon Rhea, upon Setsu, upon Hannah. And when I look at my brother Ken and all my siblings, I think, yeah, we were all left to become our own people. And I can only think that that takes a real kind of unconditional love from my dad. So, yeah, I have no doubt that I was loved. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks so much for sharing so honestly from your life and experience. And one of the things that I've observed in my brother as he has resolved the resentment and anger with dad is that his other relationships have been impacted. He has become a great husband to his wife, and he surprised us all by being such a generous, loving father. And well, by nature, you're a self-absorbed artist. And so it kind of is miraculous, you know.
I'm feeling resentment now.
Resentment. Well, do this searching, fearless moral inventory, okay? But seriously, this could be a whole nother message. But you will find, as I'm sure my colleague Andrea can affirm, that as we seek to resolve the issues in our primary relationships with God's help, then all our other relationships will tend to flourish just a little bit more. You know, the scene from the train station that my brother just depicted is part of a show that he's doing called Empire of the Sun. It's playing at the Kulch Theater here in Vancouver from October 6th to the 17th. And, you know, as his brother, naturally, I want to invite people to it, but I'm relieved, and I'm actually really happy and proud in a good way that the show is so compelling and so powerful. And I haven't asked him to do this, but if you're part of 10th and you're interested in seeing the show, there is a promo code just for 10th people. It's simply Ken10, easy to remember. Information in your program as to how to get the discount, go to the Kulch website. Now, the show has been so popular in terms of ticket sales that the first week is almost sold out. And so the Kulch has decided to limit the promo special to, is it Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of the second week, 13th, 14th, 15th. And my brother is going to be doing a bunch of interviews on Monday, tomorrow, with the CBC Vancouver Sun, you know, the media. And so my sense is that the second week is going to sell out awfully quickly. So if you're interested in seeing the show, I would urge you to buy tickets tonight online or tomorrow before the media blitz. And you can pick up cards like this in the back afterwards. It's going to be a really fantastic show. And my wife and I are going to see it. So Empire of the Sun. Lust is another of the seven deadly sins. You did such a great job with anger. How about talking about lust?
Well, I have to say, you're not prepared for this. Okay, all right.
You know, sexual desire can and is a really good thing. None of us would be here without sexual desire, if we think about it, obviously. But sexual desire can also cross a line and cause us to objectify people and use people and perhaps in extreme cases even harm people so that our selfish appetites and desires are satiated. When I was in grade 6, and I think I've shared this story with some of you, I was at the roller skating rink with some of my buddies. And we noticed right away this roller skating goddess there. You know, long, wavy blonde hair. Was an amazing skater. She could skate forwards and effortlessly pivot backwards and do the figure skating kind of twirls. And all of my buddies and I were wowed by her, and we wanted to go on a couple skate with her, which means that you ask someone to go couples with you and you hold hands and you skate around the rink to a slow dance song. But all my buddies were too chicken to ask her. And in grade 6, I was really self-confident. In fact, grade 6 was probably my all-time social peak. It's been all downhill since then. And so I skate up to her, and when I get to her, I notice that I'm looking up at her. She must have been 2 or 3 years older than me, and my confidence is ebbing away, but I ask her, hey, do you want to go on a couple skate with me? And she looks down at me and says, no. And I can kind of laugh at that now, but at the time, my sixth grade heart was just crushed. And I'm no psychologist, but I have observed that when I was a young adult, single, that I was inclined to date a beauty queen or a model or a successful actress when I had the opportunity, partly as a way to validate and bring solace to a heart that was crushed back in grade 6. You know, I'm a person who's married, and I must confess that when I first met Sakiko, part of the draw about her was that I instantly intuited that she must be wildly popular. And I know that that is superficial, but as I got to know her, she was also very kind and loving and, you know, wise and discerning and devoted to God and so forth. But even though I'm happily married now, I must confess that I sense that I have some kind of vulnerability to the goddess, because I sense that the goddess can validate me in some way, or to repair that broken part in my heart. I have that illusion. And so I engage in certain practices to foster a healthier sexuality than I would otherwise have. So for example, I make it a point to never surf onto a porn website to view the goddess in a way that I shouldn't. I make it a practice, this may sound really extreme, of never turning on the television in my hotel room. And I travel quite a bit. One time, as some of you have heard, I was traveling and feeling very restless and lonely one night. I turn on the TV and I start to channel surf, and I sense that there is going to be a scene where two people, a couple, are going to really get it on. It's going to get really hot and steamy and sexy. So I channel surf off it, but I'm curious, have they made any progress? And so I go around the dial, yes, come back onto it, and I say, yeah, they're definitely getting it on or taking it off, you know, depending on your perspective, all right? And I think, okay, I'll channel surf off it. And then I think, you know, I need to preach against this kind of casual sex. You know, I need to be informed about this. And so I channel surf back onto it. Total rationalization, obviously. And I just felt degraded and ashamed afterwards. And I just made a decision in that moment that I'll never turn the TV on in my hotel room again. And I never have. It's kind of simple, perhaps somewhat extreme steps. But I want to cultivate a healthy sexuality. You know, this past week I was speaking in New York, and one night I was speaking at this Christian university, this Christian college, and I was talking on the subject of sexuality, and I gave an altar call, and it was one of those nights where the Spirit just seemed to just pour out, you know, all over the room, and kids came forward at the altar call. They knelt and were crying and praying intensely to God till like 10, 11 p.m. at night. And a number of students came to me, and other people that were part of a kind of prayer ministry team. And they sought prayer, and they told me in many cases how their sexual history was marked by regret or pain or a sense of shame. And I prayed with them and I cried with them till late into the night. And I looked at those students one-on-one, and I said, look, I'm very happy to pray with you. But I want you to seek the help of a Christian counselor. You know, someone like Andrea. Or to enroll in a course like Journey Canada, if you were in Canada, but the equivalent in the United States. Some kind of course that will help you meet God in your sexual issues. And if you need money to do this, I'm sure that the school will provide scholarships for you, or I can find some money for you. And if you're here and sexuality has been a source of pain or regret, please don't blow it off. Please fight this battle for the health of your soul. Because much like anger, if you can cultivate with God's help a healthy sexuality, then everything else in your life will go more smoothly. It will tend to flourish. It is so worth the effort here with God's help. Please, please do something. And if you need money to see a counselor, we'll help put up the money for you. Greed is another one of the seven deadly sins. The desire to have enough, and if you're in a position one day to provide for other people, the desire to work and to have enough for your family is a noble desire. But when that desire becomes excessive and we start to want a whole lot more than we actually need to live on, that becomes selfish, and that desire, that originally good desire to provide and to have enough, starts to give less and less and take more and more. You know, many of you are students here tonight, and I know that you get your grades via email. When I was an undergrad student in Chicago, we still received our grades at the end of the semester in an actual envelope. And I remember how nervous I would be standing in front of my little post office box there in Chicago at the Student Union Building. And I pulled out the envelope of my grades, opened up the envelope, and I would read them. And it was the day of judgment for me, you know, every semester. And I know that grades aren't everything and that grades don't always accurately reflect how much we've learned. But for me, when I looked at my grades, it was a sign of how I had stewarded that semester. Not the only sign, but it was a significant one. I'm not a student anymore, thank God. But I have another day of judgment. And it's the day when I sit with my accountant as tax season comes around, and I look at the box that identifies my charitable giving. And my parents, as my brother knows, are two of the most generous people I have ever known. I'm not competing with them, but I want to live generously. And part of my own searching and fearless moral inventory when it comes to greed is looking at my tax returns and asking myself, have I been generous this past year? Have I done more than sort of the, quote, bare minimum? One of the ways to do this deep dive, as I've indicated, is through the lens of the seven deadly sins: pride, greed, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, and sloth. But let me talk practically about how we can identify these. You know, some years ago, before Jay and Melissa were on our staff and Andrea was on our team, my colleagues and I engaged in a kind of moral inventory of sorts as we each took a large piece of paper and we took post-it notes and we encouraged one another to write down the names of the people who had impacted our lives most across our lifetime. So this would represent, you know, birth, and this would represent where I am now. And so I wrote down the names of my parents and my siblings and close friends, mentors, people who had hurt me. And then on yellow post-it notes, we were to write down significant events in our life that have shaped who we are. And then on blue post-it notes, the beliefs that came out of our connection with these important people or these important events. And so, for example, Saturday at Dad's memorial service, I described how when I was 3 or 4 years old, we were living in London, England, in this three-story house. And if you were to come to our house and come into the front door and onto the main floor, you could walk to a section in our house where there was a staircase that would lead you up to the second story of our house, and then it would turn right and there would be a banister, and the banister would kind of wind around in a rectangle, and then you would come to a second set of stairs, and if you would climb up those stairs, it would lead you to a third story, also with a rectangular banister. And from the third story of the house, you could look over the banister and see down to the ground floor. And when I was 3 or 4 years old, my dad had this habit of taking me in his hands and stretching me out over the banister from the third floor. I was looking down at the ground floor, feeling kind of scared, but kind of entertained at the same time. And I remember, especially as he was about to die, how safe and how loved I felt in his hands. And as my brother just implied, you know, Dad was not the kind of guy who would hug us or say, I love you. But across my lifetime, I have really felt safe and loved in his hands, in a manner of speaking. And I checked, because I did this years ago, and sure enough, one of the yellow post-it notes describes how Dad held me over the banister and how I felt loved. Sure enough, when I double-checked, the story of the roller skating goddess is on here too. And the blue post-it note that rejection is painful. And this past week, as I mentioned, I spent a little time in New York. And as I was at this school of speaking, I was assigned an assistant, actually a few people that were assisting me with various things. And at the end of my time, one of the people that was helping me out, Siobhan, she looked at me and she said, "Ken, I sense that you are a warrior." And as I left, I took my journal and I began to write down what I recalled from our conversation. And then I thought to myself, you know, back when I was in high school, in my senior year, when I was playing basketball, during the final minutes of the game, if the game was still being contested, people would start to look at me as a warrior. They were expecting me to step up. And I was curious, did I write about this on the sheet? And I looked at this when I got back from New York. And sure enough, I think it's around here that I simply write basketball and how it shaped my heart to become a kind of competitor, which obviously can have a dark side, as I talked about a couple of weeks ago. But I want to fight also for the state of my soul with God's help. And I invite you to do the same. To actually write out and journal about, maybe use the post-it notes or buy a journal if you don't have one, and write down where you might be vulnerable. Maybe take the seven deadly sins and ask yourself, where might I fall when it comes to these seven deadly sins? And to take time to honestly journal about it, and to also write about your strengths as they have been identified by other people. And then to anticipate next Sunday, as we look at step 5, to turn to a trusted friend of yours or a trusted pastor like Jay, who happens to also be a counselor or a spiritual director or a trusted life group, and to begin to share some of the vulnerabilities you have and to confess some of the weaknesses and even sins you have committed. There is something really powerful about confessing a sin that causes the power of the temptation that caused you to sin in the first place to be diminished. There's something freeing about it. But obviously it takes humility. If you're proud, you won't do this. You won't think you'll need to do this. Or you want to save face, and so you won't do this, even though you think it might be helpful. It takes humility to do this and courage, but I urge you to do it. And speaking of being with trusted people, you know, as the eye has a blind spot in the retina, our eyeball has a blind spot in the retina, so our souls have a blind spot. We don't see certain parts of who we are, and so it can be really helpful to turn to a trusted friend and to ask, where can I grow? Where am I falling short? Where do I need to work on my character? On a fairly regular basis, I'll ask my wife, Sakiko, where am I falling short? Where can I grow? Where can I be better? I don't ask my siblings that, because they'll just tell me voluntarily, you know, all my shortcomings and faults. And it's painful, to be honest. And they have no hesitation telling me. But I try to listen and ponder what they're saying and pray over it and journal about it and say, God, where is the truth here? And how can I grow? And how can I become more like you? You know, we began this message by my talking about how when we turn to certain things and over-desire and over-depend on them, that they start to give less and less and take more and more. The one exception to this kind of cycle is when we turn to Jesus Christ and cultivate with God's help a desire for Him. And when we long more and more for Jesus Christ, we find that Jesus Christ doesn't give less and less and take more and more. No, Jesus Christ simply gives more and more and more and more. And 2,000 years ago, Jesus Christ at age 33, after having lived a perfect life as the unique Son of God, voluntarily hung on a Roman cross, absorbing our sin and our shame into himself, so that we could be given a clean start, a fresh slate with God and with life. And Jesus is the one who gave it all for you and continues to give and give and give. And if you will turn to him and invite him to shine his light into your soul and to conduct a searching and fearful moral inventory of your life, he will. And Jesus Christ will help to set you free. Will you pray with me? If this expresses your heart's desire, please pray the Psalm of David found in Psalm 139 in your heart. Search me, O God, and know my heart. You can pray it right along, phrase by phrase if you want. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. This kind of sermon is not the kind of sermon ideally that ends with an amen, but goes on through Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, ideally week after week across your whole lifetime. And may I invite you, if you're open to this searching and fearless moral inventory, to buy a journal if you don't have one. And consider the seven deadly sins as a lens through which to do the searching, fearless moral inventory. You know, some of you I know have taken classes like biochem. I was an economics major. I've taken some tough econ classes. The hardest class you'll ever take, the most challenging course you'll ever have, is a course on your own life. But it will also be the most fruitful one. The ancient advice to know yourself is as relevant today as it's ever been. Will you roll up your sleeves and with God's help take the longest journey of all? And it'll be a lifetime journey to know yourself, that you might know God, that you might be made whole with his help. I urge you to engage in this hard journey, because it'll be so worth it. It will bear more dividends and more fruit than any course you've ever taken. And so why not pray, Jesus Christ, please shine the light of your presence into my soul. Take my hand and lead me on this searching and fearless moral inventory, that I might be set free, that I might be whole. And we pray these things in the name of Jesus Christ, our friend, our older brother, our redeemer, and our freer. Amen.